My name is Yihui. It's great to be back here in Pearl River. I was actually here as an undergrad summer student. So that is my fun fact for today, Annie. It's also the most fun thing about me. I'm going to talk to you about maybe another perspective on error mitigation from what you might be familiar with, namely a perspective, an information theoretic perspective on error mitigation. And the title of my presentation is Beware the Logjam. Or sorry, beware the logjam. So who here knows what a logjam is? Okay, well, fortunately, I... What?
Is this like a metaphor or an actual literal logjam?
Well, a logjam is an actual thing, but a logjam is something that only makes sense in the context of this paper. Because in this paper, we conclude that error mitigation becomes hard at log depth or polylog depth. And so I am now going to tell you what a logjam is. Oh, before that, I need to mention my wonderful collaborators, Daniel, Sumit, Johannes, and Jens, who are also on this paper. So what is a logjam? So a logjam is apparently a situation that occurs quite a lot in Canada, which is why I titled my slides, Beware the Logjam. A logjam is something that happens when you have a river and you have a lot of like logging activity near the river, and then logs fall into the river. And then this gradually makes the river congest, or like the logs pack together very tightly, and then the river cannot flow. And this is called a logjam. So today I'm going to talk about the logjam as an analogy to what happens in a noisy quantum circuit, namely, picture a family of quantum circuits of increasing depth, and these are noisy quantum circuits because that's the situation that you encounter with NISQ devices. And at some particular depth, in this paper we're going to show that that depth is poly log n, the noise causes errors to pile up in the quantum circuit, and this makes the errors become classically unsolvageable. The computation cannot flow. So a logjam is a very bad situation for everyone who is into logging because they are very dangerous to fix. But we see an analogous situation in quantum circuits. So logjams block quantum computation, and it turns out that if you try to remove the errors in your noisy quantum circuit by classical post-processing, which is what error mitigation tries to do, then you often have to resort to running the circuit exponentially many times in order to get an accurate result. Okay, so let's be a bit more specific about what we mean by error mitigation. So error mitigation is kind of a near-term surrogate to quantum error correction. And there have been high hopes for error mitigation, and some people think that error mitigation is something that's going to get us to a full-scale quantum computer because it's something that we can do in the near term or something that we can already test out on really small quantum devices. So the way a typical quantum computation proceeds is that you have a quantum circuit running some algorithm of interest, and then it ends with a measurement. And the measurement, you can either do it on multiple copies, which gives you some expectation value, or in some cases, just the result of the measurement is already encoding the answer to the computation. But this is in the ideal case when you have noiseless quantum computers. So in the quantum devices that we see today, the quantum circuit is often going to be very noisy. And those of you who are physicists will be familiar with the various sources of noise in a quantum circuit. They can come about for instance, qubit decoherence or gate errors. And the way we model this mathematically is that we consider a quantum circuit where the circuit layers are interspersed with depolarizing noise or some other kinds of noise models that we also consider. But the point is that the noise happens after every circuit layer. And because the quantum circuit is noisy, naturally, the result of the quantum computation is also noisy. So the idea of quantum error mitigation is that maybe it's possible to correct the effect of noise on the result of the computation by doing classical post-processing. So in general, what you do is you attach some kind of like classical algorithm that is able to make some small amount of some small like circuit and then do a measurement on the result of the circuit. And the measurement results are then post-processed to correct the effect of the noise on the quantum computation. So to make this more concrete, I'm going to give you an example of an error mitigation protocol. And this particular protocol that I'm going to talk about, there are many such protocols, is called zero noise extrapolation. And as the name suggests, it's going to be some kind of extrapolation procedure on the noisy computation. And you're going to like extrapolate back the noisy computation to zero noise. So how does this work? So the assumption is that you're able to not remove the noise from your circuit, but you're able to increase the noise in your circuit. And the way you do this on a gate level is like you run the gate for like longer periods of time or something. And so if you're able to run the circuit at various different noise levels, then you can run it at various increasing noise level. And at every new noise level, you measure the expectation value of some observable that you're interested in. So this is going to give you a single noisy result. But then you do this for various levels of noise. Then you get multiple noisy results. And then basically, you have some model of how the value of this observable will scale in the amount of noise of the circuit. And so you do a fit of your noisy results, and you extrapolate the results back to zero noise. Yeah, so then you output the extrapolated value, which is the expectation value when the circuit has zero noise. So we ask the question of whether this is fundamentally a viable way of removing noise. Because the whole premise of error mitigation is that you have some kind of quantum noise, but then your quantum device is very limited. And you're shifting a lot of the burden of computation to the classical post-processing. So if you believe that quantum computers are more powerful than classical computers, then you should be skeptical of this proposal, because you are trying to remove quantum noise in a classical way. And another reason to be skeptical actually comes from reports on the ground. So people who actually work on error mitigation protocols have found that actually the sampling overhead of these protocols does scale very badly in the complexity of the circuit that you're trying to error mitigate. So for the protocol called probabilistic error cancellation, it was found that the circuit sampling overhead scales exponentially in both the number of qubits and the depth of the circuit. And for zero noise extrapolation, which is a protocol that I showed you just now, a similar scaling has been found. So empirically, it doesn't look too good. And the purpose of today's talk is to provide a theoretical basis for these observations. So let's make this model of error mitigation more formal. We're going to try and define one framework that captures a lot of error mitigation protocols. So the way this framework works is that you have an error mitigation algorithm, which is classical. And this algorithm has the ability to run the noisy circuit and measure it. And then it mostly does the classical post-processing on the circuit. So how do we model a noisy circuit? As mentioned just now, there are two important parameters of the circuit. So the circuit has a certain number of qubits, n, and a certain depth, d. And oh, yeah, we model the noise as occurring after every layer of the circuit. And to be more concrete, let's consider the model of depolarizing noise. And this is local depolarizing noise. So local depolarizing noise means like every layer of noise is n tensor copies of single qubit depolarizing noise. And depolarizing noise is noise that acts as written here. So this is noise that retains the operator that it acts on with some probability. And with the complement of that probability, it just replaces that with a maximally mixed state. And you should think of this as, with some probability, it retains the quantum information that you care about. And otherwise, it replaces it with something that's totally useless. So that's depolarizing noise, yes?
Across different samples, is the noise same, or like here you have multiple samples of row? Mm-hmm. Is the noise in the circuit for all of them the same as that?
Yeah, so it's actually equivalent. So we our analysis covers the case when the noise isn't the same. But for the purposes of simplicity, we're going to assume that the noise is the same. And the way you extend our results to the case when the noise isn't the same is you have to look at how depolarizing noise composes. And you have to assume that there's like some minimal level of depolarizing noise, which all of them respect. OK, so that is the noise model that we assume. And again, for the purposes of simplicity, we're going to assume that all of the circuits that are input to your error mitigation algorithm are the same, and they're producing the same output state. And our analysis also extends to the case when they are different, but the circuits have similar depth. But we won't talk about that extension today. So you have multiple copies of a particular noisy state. And this is the input to the error mitigation algorithm. Now, what is the output of the algorithm? It is these expectation values that you care about. So because I said that in a noiseless computation, you're often interested in expectation values of the output of the circuit. So the point of error mitigation is to give you the results that you would get if you were able to run a noiseless circuit. So the output of error mitigation is expectation values. We also talk about another model of error mitigation in which you're actually interested not in expectation values, but in samples from the noisy circuit. And we call this strong error mitigation. But today we'll focus on the case when you're only interested in expectation values of the output of the circuit. Okay, so let's take a step back. What is error mitigation? It is a process of converting noisy circuit output states to noiseless circuit output states, or rather information about noiseless circuit output states. So this already hints at the way we analyze error mitigation, which is we look at it as a process of statistical inference, because statistical inference is all about inferring properties of distributions under noise. So to make our question slightly more formal, we ask, how many copies of the noisy output state, the noisy circuit output state, does the error mitigation algorithm need in order to estimate these expectation values to a particular accuracy, precision, epsilon, with probability 1 minus delta? And this is the last time I'll be talking about the parameters epsilon and delta. They are not interesting. We are more interested in the answer to this question, how many copies do you need, in terms of the circuit width and depth, so parameters N and D, as well as the amount of noise in the circuit, P. So three important parameters, N, D, and P. So I'm now going to summarize our results, and then I'll tell you about how we derive our results. Our results are lower bounds on this quantity. We show that you need at least a certain number of copies of the circuit in order to do this denoising procedure. So the first theorem is when you assume that the circuit is affected by depolarizing noise. And we show then that the number of copies of this noisy state that you need is going to scale as exponential in N and D, where the base of the exponential is the depolarizing noise parameter, P. And this result kicks in when the depth of the circuit is actually like polylog log in N. So then, the second theorem is now we assume a different noise model, and we assume that the circuit is not affected by depolarizing noise, but instead affected by non-unital noise. Non-unital noise is noise that does not preserve the identity, and it's much trickier to analyze than depolarizing noise. However, non-unital noise is it covers like certain classes of physical processes that I won't really talk about, and that's why it's important to also analyze non-unital noise. And here, we obtain a very similar scaling of the number of the sample complexity. And the scaling is similarly some kind of constant depending on the noise model, and it's exponential in N and D. So why do I keep on harping on the fact that our results are exponential in both N and D? Well, it's because the previous belief was that only exponential in D number of copies of the noisy state are required to do error mitigation. However, when do you want to do error mitigation? You want to do it on circuits that have very low depth. Namely, you want to do it on circuits that have depth at most logarithmic in N. What do you get when you exponentiate logarithmic in N? You get polynomial in N. So the previous belief then translates to the statement that the number of copies you require for error mitigation is polynomial in N. And this actually doesn't sound so bad. However, our results show that the number of copies you need is exponential in both N and D. And this is a true exponential in N. So our results are an exponential improvement over previous results. So As a consequence of our results, we can also show that certain quantum machine learning subroutines actually don't give you a quantum advantage when they are much less deep than was previously assumed in the presence of noise. And this is ongoing work. And another consequence of our results is that if you want to use your near-term quantum circuit to prepare the ground state of some Hamiltonian, and this circuit is affected by noise, then if you're going to do error mitigation on this circuit, then the resulting algorithm is not going to give you any exponential quantum advantage. At most, you can get an advantage, which is an improvement in the exponent, because there are classical algorithms that do the same with a similar runtime. OK, so I'm now going to go into the proof technique, but I guess we have a little bit of time. So up to now, does anyone want to ask any questions about the setup and the results? Yes.
So to be clear, like this error mitigation is different from error correction.
It's different from error correction.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And the way that it's different, OK, so this is actually a pretty deep question, because I also have a slide on this. It's a pretty deep question, because like we know that error correction works under some reasonable sounding assumptions. And but our results, by contrast, show that error mitigation doesn't work. So this brings up the question, where exactly is the dividing line between something that we know that works and something that we know doesn't work? And this is a question I'm very interested to explore. But one extremely obvious difference between our model of error mitigation and error correction, OK, actually, I have it here. So the difference is that this is not actually how error correction works. In error correction, you do not run your entire circuit, and then you correct the results classically. In error correction, you do these corrections kind of on the fly. You measure your circuit inside the circuit, and then you kind of like project it onto some stabilizer state, and then you like do some adaptive unitary to correct that. And all of these operations are not allowed in our model here. So that is the difference between our model and error correction. There is one difference. I don't know if that is the difference that makes our results fail for error correction. So thank you for the question. Does anyone else have any questions? Yes?
So you said there is no noisy circuit would work for state preparation.
Yeah.
If I add some ancilla qubits, would that help at all?
Yeah, maybe. Because I haven't really thought too deeply about this result. But the point is that any form of like ground state preparation that escapes our assumptions is not affected by our results.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe like you had an assumption that we do not use a like larger Hilbert space or something like that, not using extra ancilla qubits.
Yeah, I think that results. I think that if you have fresh ancillas, then that would definitely escape our results.
So yes. Following up on that,
yeah.
What family of Hamiltonians would your lower bounds apply to? Can you comment on that or?
Oh, you mean for the ground state preparation? Basically, families of Hamiltonians for which you already have like classical simulation or classical algorithms to prepare ground states, or like in that they run in exponential time.
Okay. So I guess I don't see like how does your lower bound translate to like this notice algorithm for ground state preparation? What's the connection?
Right. So this connection is something that I haven't talked about at all.
Okay.
But so I think the idea is that I don't really mean ground state preparation, but I mean like estimating properties of ground states, right? So there are classical algorithms for that run in exponential time. And I just wanted to make the point that because our algorithm also runs in exponential time, if you like, we show that if you use error correction on your like noisy quantum circuits for that also runs in exponential time.
Right.
So they're both going to run in exponential time. So why don't you just use the classical algorithm instead?
Okay.
Yeah. So any more questions? Or yes?
I just had a question about a quote that you had put earlier about
mm-hmm.
IBM's results on how their gamma for probabilistic error cancellation
mm-hmm.
scales.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering that since they also arrived at this conclusion that it scales exponentially
yeah.
with like N and D both, like are there any similarities in your strategy and how they arrived at that conclusion?
Yeah, our strategy is meant to be a generalization of their strategy.
Oh, okay.
Because what we do is we look at all these individual algorithms for error mitigation, and we say that, oh, these algorithms all have the following similarities. And we try to encapsulate all of those similarities in this framework, like this framework. So we believe that this framework encompasses a lot of like individual error mitigation algorithms, including the probabilistic error translation.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
So in the end, you're estimating some observable, right?
Yes. Yes.
How do you choose that? Or if that's part of the problem statement?
Yeah, that is part of the problem statement. So So maybe it'll become a bit clearer in like one of the next few slides, because we have to like construct a family of observables and a family of circuits such that error mitigation is hard. Anyone else? Okay, then let's go on. Okay, so I'm going to talk about how we prove the results that we mentioned, the exponential in N and D lower bound on the number of noisy copies you need. So our strategy proceeds in three steps. The first step is we define a learning problem that can be solved by error mitigation. And this learning problem is something I call noisy state distinguishability. Next, the reason we choose this learning problem is that we actually know how to bound it. Namely, we know how to bound the complexity of this learning problem by a certain relative entropy quantity, which I'm going to talk about later. And the last step is that from step two, we only get an expression to lower bound the sample complexity of this learning problem. But this expression depends on what circuits you put into the error mitigation algorithm. So then, in step three, we construct circuits for which this bound evaluates to an enormous quantity, like namely exponential n and d. And these circuits are highly entangling, which is why I have represented them with cats.
And Christmas tree lights?
Yeah, I think the link is that if you put cats near Christmas tree lights, cats also turn out to be highly entangling objects. So let's talk about part one first. How to construct this noisy state distinguishability problem, which lower bounds the complexity of error mitigation. So what is the problem that I've been calling noisy state distinguishability? So it's a state distinguishability problem, but the states are noisy. So in state distinguishability, you have a known set of states. Let's call them S. And you're handed one state in this set, but it's not exactly that state. You're handed a noisy version of that state. And you're allowed to request m copies of it. So the C prime is just like a noisy circuit. The prime denotes the noise. And you know what the noise is. You know what the original circuit is, and you know what the noise is. So then you want to output what actually was the state that you were handed, but the noiseless version of the state that you were handed. And this is called noisy state distinguishability. Okay. So I'm now going to explain why we can make the statement that an error mitigation algorithm implies that you can distinguish noisy states. And in order to do this, I'm going to construct a noisy state distinguishability problem. And I'm going to make what my boss Boaz Barak calls a belly argument, which is that I'm going to construct a solver for the noisy state distinguishability problem that has in its belly an error mitigation algorithm. And if I can do this, it means that any lower bounds that pertain to the noisy state distinguishability problem must also lower bound the complexity of the thing in the belly, which is the error mitigation algorithm. OK, so how do I construct this noisy state distinguishability problem? Well, I'm going to choose a set of states. And this set of states is going to be the set of computational basis states and the maximally mixed state. So you're either handed a computational basis state on n qubits, or you're handed the maximally mixed state. But not that, but the noisy versions of those things. So that is the set of states that you're given. And you're also given the classical descriptions of the noise and the noiseless circuit. So how does this solver for noisy state distinguishability work? OK, so it's going to have an error mitigation algorithm in its belly. So this error mitigation algorithm takes in m tensor copies of the noisy circuit's output state, as well as these classical descriptions. And it actually also has, so its goal is to output the expectation values of these observables, which we chose. Now, what are these observables? These observables are the Pauli Zs, individual Pauli Zs, but they are evolved by the noiseless circuit. Why do we choose these observables? It's because these observables have a special property that allows the error mitigation algorithm to solve noisy state distinguishability. And that property is this property. That property is simply the fact that the very expectation values of these observables that we care about translate into these trace of Pauli Zs on rho I's. So a successful error mitigation algorithm will output these values with some precision, epsilon. And so let's consider multiple cases. In case one, the unknown state for noisy state distinguishability is the maximally mixed state. Now, the value of trace Zj on the maximally mixed state is going to be 0 because Paulis are traceless. On the other hand, if the unknown state was the computational basis state, then the values of Zj's on the computational basis state is going to be literally the jth bit of the label that identifies the computational basis state. And this is going to be either plus or minus 1. And you can see already that these two cases, depending on what your noisy state was, the error mitigation algorithm is going to output very different answers. And because these answers are going to be so different, you can easily tell what was the actual input to the noisy state distinguishability algorithm.
So
yes?
OJ, you're saying, is a noisy observable?
OJ is a noiseless observable.
Okay.
This C is a noiseless circuit.
How do you make this choice such that equality, OJ, C of rho I, is ZJ
rho I? Oh, so if you substitute OJ equals to C of ZJ, you can just think of like C as like some unitary because it's like a noiseless circuit. And then C of ZJ is like U, ZJ, U inverse.
Right.
And C of rho I is U, rho I, U inverse. So you bring the first U to the other side.
Okay. Cool.
And then that becomes just this.
Makes sense.
Anybody have any questions? Any other questions? Okay. Cool. So then, because we've constructed the problem to be in such a way that depending on what the original state was, the error mitigation algorithm gives you very different results. This means that with some simple classical post-processing, you can get out what exactly was the identifier of the state that went in. Yes, do you have another question?
Yeah, just the confusion that for ZJ,
mm-hmm.
the subscript is like the site on the...
Yeah, thing. Exactly. It's the qubit on which the Pauli Z acts.
But for rho, it's like indexing the copy number.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for pointing that out. That was indeed that notation. Actually, it's not a copy number. It's like the label of the computational basis state.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So I'm going to go on. Okay, so just to summarize what this slide implies, it implies that based on the outputs of error mitigation, you can always infer the input state to this noisy state distinguishability problem. And so this error mitigation solves the noisy state distinguishability problem. Now I'm going to go into part two. How do I lower bound the sample complexity of the noisy state distinguishability problem? Well, this was not actually our contribution. Some person called Fano, which some of you may know from information theory, has already solved this problem in the past. And Fano has this lemma, which is that if you have n plus 1 possible probability distributions, and you're allowed to draw a single sample from it, then if you try to use that sample to distinguish which of the probability distributions it was, then this test must fail with a probability 1 minus alpha. But what is alpha? Alpha is linked to how far apart these probability distributions are. And this quantity here is what some of you may know as the KL divergence between probability distributions. In the quantum world, this is just a relative entropy. And so a KL divergence is like a distance measure between probability distributions. Like, you know how to measure distances between numbers. This is just how to measure distances between probability distributions. So if this number is very small, it means that the probability distributions are very close together. And if it's large, it means that they are far apart.
I think the statement is missing P0, like the distributions P1 to Pn, you written
like that. Oh, yeah. Indeed, there should be a P0 here. Yeah. So then the failure probability of a test to distinguish probability distributions is given by basically something related to how far apart the distributions are. This should make intuitive sense. And the way we are going to use the statement is that we're going to choose the PIs to be the outputs of the noisy state distinguisher on different possible inputs. Because recall, we care about lower bounding the sample complexity of distinguishing noisy states, of the noisy state distinguishability problem. So we're going to choose PI to be the output of the noisy state distinguisher on the input of the circuit initialized with a computational basis state I. And Pn, we will choose that to be the output of this distinguisher when the noisy circuit is initialized with the maximally mixed state. And so what we're eventually going to show is that there exists noisy states such that the value of alpha scales exponentially in both n and d. But it also has this factor of m, which is the number of copies of the noisy state that you need. And because we are going to show this equality in the third stage of our proof, so then if you want this noisy state distinguisher to fail with a certain error, with a certain constant error probability, then you have to choose m to be exponential in both d and n. Namely, you have to choose a number of copies of the noisy state that is exponential in both d and n, which is exactly what our result says. So then step three is just going to be about establishing this equality here.
So in the original problem setup, what is capital N?
In the original problem setup, it's just like the number of probability distributions that you have to discriminate between.
Oh, okay, like the sample complexity, basically.
No, n is the number of possible probability distributions, and m is the number of samples you take from one of them.
Okay.
What's the small c?
Oh, so c is a parameter that depends on, that we're going to show later, depends on the amount of noise or the noise model in the circuit. In the case when the circuit is affected by depolarizing noise, then C is going to be the depolarizing noise parameter.
So,
yes?
Especially for the sum of the KL divergences,
yeah,
that looks somewhat asymmetric.
Pn
on one side.
Right. That's a good observation. So the point is that
it's just a choice, right?
It's just a choice, but it's a choice that has a lot of history.
Okay.
So I don't know if I wrote this here. Yes, okay, so thank you for letting me talk about this point. So there are a lot of results in quantum information theory that depend on comparing the output of your algorithm on a meaningful state to the output of your algorithm on a meaningless state. Mm-hmm. What is a meaningless state? The maximally mixed state.
Okay.
So this Pn here, as Anirban correctly pointed out, is always the same Pn, depending no matter what the k is. And we choose this Pn to be the maximally mixed state, or the output of the quantum circuit initialized on the maximally mixed state. So this is exactly in this tradition of comparing of all these previous results. But I do want to point out that whereas previous results that use this technique of comparing your algorithm's output to the algorithm's output on maximally mixed state, we're only able to show that this quantity, this relative entropy, scales in the depth of the circuit. Our results have constructed circuits where this quantity scales exponentially in both the depth and the number of qubits of the circuit. So that's the difference between, from previous results. Okay, now I'm going to finally talk about how we construct these circuits that make this bound extremely, extremely large. So recall the goal is to prove this equality here. We are going to show circuits such that when you compute this like average relative entropy here, then this average relative entropy is going to be is going to scale exponentially in both the d and the n of the circuit. That's what we're going to do now. Okay, this is also the technically most involved part of our work. So I'm going to start off with some kind of intuition, and I hope that I can convey the intuition well. Okay, so our proof relies on a particular construction that was actually came from a paper written in Waterloo. And this paper is by Cleef, Liu, and Wang. And it is a construction of a Clifford circuit that becomes a two design very quickly. And when I say very quickly, it means that in terms of the depth of the Clifford circuit, this Clifford circuit becomes a two design at depth log square n. And what is a two design? Okay, a two design is an ensemble of circuits that basically looks as if it is truly random. But it's a common theme in computer science that truly random objects are very difficult to construct. And so you often settle for objects that look random and are random for all computational purposes, but are much simpler to construct. And a two design is exactly such an object. It's an ensemble of circuits that are very shallow, but they look as if they are random. And when I say look as if they're random, it means that if you take expectation values on the output with like simple observables, when we're not going to define the word simple, then these expectation values are going to be exactly the same as the expectation values if you were to take the expectation values on truly random circuits. That's what a two design is. And so our circuit construction hinges on our ability to imitate randomness in this way. So how are we going to use these circuits to construct noisy circuits that make this relative entropy small? Well, the first link is that relative entropy is a complicated object. So what we're going to do is that we're going to upper bound relative entropy by something known as the purity of the circuit's output state. And it suffices to, because of this upper bound, so log of purity upper bounds the, log of purity plus n upper bounds the relative entropy. And so it suffices to make the purity extremely small. How do you make the purity small? Well, it turns out that random quantum circuits have this property where they kind of, if you expand the purity in terms of the contributions of the various Paulis in the state, then random quantum circuits kind of shift this contribution to higher weight Paulis. And I'll make this like maybe a bit more precise in the next few slides. And the reason why this makes the purity very small is that depolarizing noise is a Pauli channel. And so it acts exponentially in the weight of the Paulis. So if you have circuits that are making the purity, that are shifting the purity contribution to higher weight Paulis, then when you next act on that with depolarizing noise, that's going to like destroy the purity contribution very badly. So I'm going to make this more precise now. Okay, so I'm going to expand a quantum state progressing through our circuit in terms of the Pauli basis. But it's not going to be exactly that. I'm going to group the Paulis by their Pauli weight. So for a given Pauli string, the Pauli weight is the number of non-identities in that string. So I expand the purity in terms of the Pauli weights. And then I'm going to plot the contribution of various Pauli weights to the purity. And this contribution is going to depend on what the state was. And for the input state to our circuits, which are computational basis state, then this graph is going to look like a binomial. I will not explain why it looks like a binomial, but the key point is that this input state to our circuit has like a Pauli graph that looks kind of like balanced. However, it turns out that every time you apply a layer of our circuit, this graph is going to shift more and more towards the higher weight Paulis. And I'm going to kind of illustrate that now. So our circuits, let me remind you, are created by putting in a computational basis state and then acting with this like Cleave circuits, acting with a layer of noise, acting with the Cleave circuits again, acting with another layer of noise, and then so on and so forth. And this is a simplified model because there is actually also noise within the Cleave circuits, but we can also account for that. So let's just look in this simplified model how this purity behaves. So initially, you input a computational basis state. And on the previous slide, I showed that the computational basis state has a graph that looks basically like a binomial. But once you act with a random quantum circuit, this binomial shifts to the right. So it puts more weight on higher weight Pauli strings. Now, I said also that depolarizing noise acts exponentially in the weight of the Pauli strings. So when you then go to the next layer and act with one layer of depolarizing noise, the Pauli strings on the right-hand side, which are the higher weight Pauli strings, are going to be damped a lot by the noise. And so you see in this purple curve, compare that to the orange curve, which is what the state was before the layer of noise acted, this purple curve is going to be significantly lower than the orange curve in this region because of how depolarizing noise acts. But depolarizing noise doesn't really have a significant effect on the Pauli strings, which have low weight. And so in this region, the purple curve is almost the same as the orange curve. So this is the effect of acting with one layer of a random quantum circuit, one random quantum circuit and then one layer of noise. Okay, now let's look again at what happens when you when you progress one more step in the quantum circuit and you act with another random quantum circuit. So that is going to shift this graph further to the right again, because that's just how random quantum circuits work. And then when you act with more depolarizing noise, that again acts disproportionately more on this region and doesn't really act on this region. And so the cycle repeats. And if you do this enough times, then you're going to get a purity that is very, very, very small.
So in the second graph,
yeah,
when you include depolarizing noise, mm-hmm, the curve shifts left or right?
So our circuits are just alternating the random part and the depolarizing noise part.
Right.
The random part shifts the curve to the right. The depolarizing noise part shifts the curve downwards, but only on the high weight Paulis.
Okay.
And you just keep on doing this operation, like this cycle of operations.
But at the very end, it seems to push a little bit again.
That's because, okay, so this third graph is describing what happens in between this step and this step. So this is what happens when you act with one layer of a random quantum circuit. This shifts the curve to the right again. So, yeah, I just wanted to say that this cycle keeps on repeating.
It seems like the height changed, or?
No, this is just a caricature.
Okay.
So that was all I intended to say about the construction of our circuits. So basically, we constructed circuits such that their purity decays very rapidly. Their purity decays very rapidly means that the relative entropy becomes very small at a very short depth. And plugging this into Fano's lemma, it turns out that when you work out the details, then this relative entropy is upper bounded by like a very, very tiny quantity at a particular, a very, very tiny quantity that scales with the depth of the circuit and the number of qubits. So that's how we get this equality here. Okay. Yes?
Just to be clear, so this Cleave circuit that you showed us,
mm-hmm,
in your original picture where you were using the noisy state distinguishability thing,
mm-hmm,
that would be the circuit you would use in one
exactly
wire of your...
Not one wire, but it would be the circuit that I use in... Okay, I don't know what you mean by one wire, but like...
Yeah, like as in one wire in your diagram would be substituted with like that entire circuit.
Yes, so... this thing would be the Cleave circuit.
Oh.
The noisy version of the Cleave circuit. Okay, so I'm now going to conclude with an outlook and some frequently asked questions. So the first frequently asked questions, is exactly what you asked just now, which is, why doesn't your analysis also kill error correction? Because what actually is the difference between error mitigation and error correction? Well, and the answer I gave you just now, which I'm going to repeat, because I think it prompts a lot of thought on future work, is that in our model, we don't allow the error mitigation algorithm to do something that error correction does, which is that we don't allow the error mitigation algorithm to measure at an intermediate stage of the computation, apply some kind of like unitary that depends on the result of that measurement, and introduce fresh ancillas. So this then brings up the question, which of these ingredients is the one that really makes error correction work? I don't know the answer, but maybe someone here can work this out. And then another question that I sometimes get is, well, physicists are concerned not with the worst case, but with the average case. So physicists are concerned with maybe can a particular class of circuits be error mitigated? But what you have shown in this work is that there is one very pathological circuit that can't be error mitigated. And my response to this is that this is a valid criticism. Our results are indeed worst case bounds. They are not average case bounds. And what you can infer from our results is just that you can't expect error mitigation to be a panacea that you can just tack on to the back of any circuit and it will work. No, it doesn't work like that. What is an area that I would be interested to explore further is whether our conclusions hold up for some kind of circuit that is closer to the kind of circuit that you would use error mitigation on. In this work, we've already tried to bring these like pathological circuits closer to a typical circuit by kind of like showing that our results have a depth dependence and a number of qubits dependence, because like in a typical near-term application, the depth is very small. But something that isn't really representative of our circuits is that the Cleave construction, which we use to construct our circuit, requires all-to-all connectivity. And this is not something that would be a feature of many near-term devices. So could that be the reason why our results hold? I don't know. And I also want to explore this more. So I'm now going to conclude. So the first question is, could there actually be a link between entanglement generation and noise sensitivity? And the reason I ask this question is that in the Cleave construction, those circuits spread entanglement very fast, because like as I showed you in the graphs, like the plots that were like tracking the progress of the state through the circuit, after one round of the random quantum circuit, the purity actually shifts, the purity contribution actually shifts towards correlators that are of high weight. And this is a sign that these circuits spread entanglement very quickly. Does this actually have anything to do with the sensitivity of those circuits to noise? I think the answer should be yes, because just from an intuitive standpoint, a circuit that is highly entangling is going to like spread any like perturbation very fast. But I don't know how to make this concrete. And the second open question is actually derived from the frequently asked question. Could there be an average case version of these results where we kind of make our circuits even more representative of the circuits that people really use for in error mitigation? And then the last question is something that I've now mentioned three times, which is what is an intermediate regime where you try and deal with quantum errors in a way that escapes the bounds that we proved in this work, but is still feasible in the near term? So what is an intermediate regime between error mitigation and error correction? And that was actually the end of my presentation. So now I'm going to open the floor for questions. Thank you.
I've read a similar sort of paper by Ippoliti et al. So it's like, it discusses how the support of operators grows locally scrambling on solver.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they have some similar ideas that you discussed. Can you comment about how that cleave circuit actually looks like?
Oh, so the cleave circuit is, okay, it's a rather remarkable circuit. So I'm glad to have the opportunity to like talk a little bit about it. So this cleave circuit is a circuit that firstly becomes an exact two design at very short depth. Why is it able to do that? Because it has ancillars. And I believe that without ancillars, you wouldn't be able to get to a two design at such short depth. And
ancillars.
Oh, it has like order of n ancillars. And like the exact construction is very technical, and I haven't really gone through it in detail. But you can look at this paper.
So you said that there were previous constructions that got only to like exponential d.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what did those look like, the construction for the circuits?
Oh, those did not use any construction at all. Those used the strong data processing inequality, which holds for all circuits. The strong data processing inequality says that when you act with one layer of depolarizing noise on your circuit, then that changes the relative entropy to the maximally mixed state by adding a factor of p. And so with every extra layer, you get an additional factor of p. So the number of factors of p you accumulate is d, which is the number of layers that you get.
So when you move from the depolarizing noise to non-unital noise, you change the parameter p to c, right? But
yeah.
Could you describe what the parameter c means? P was the probability of the error for depolarization.
Oh, there. Okay, so I do not remember this. And the reason I don't remember this is because there is no intuitive meaning to that parameter c. Yeah, you would have to.
A mathematical definition or something?
Yeah, there's a mathematical definition, but it's like a little bit complicated. It's not something that I can succinctly describe now.
So, and that's a constant? It just depends on the noise parameter?
Yeah, it just depends on the noise channel. Yes?
I have more of a comment on one of your last questions about
mm-hmm.
how we could tell the difference between error correction and error mitigation.
Oh, yeah?
And also, like, it's related to, in the next slide, your
mm-hmm.
first question about
mm-hmm.
the relation between entanglement and
mm-hmm.
sensitivity. So I'm actually, like, this is reminding me of this work by Charlie Bennett from back when, like, they were still discovering error-correcting codes.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this seminal paper on how an entanglement distillation protocol is equivalent to doing error correction.
Mm-hmm.
And so over there also, they were looking at the entanglement entropy of some mixed state
mm-hmm.
That you've gotten. And you can basically use that to quantify how much entanglement you can distill from the state that you've gotten. And that is like directly equivalent to doing an error correction protocol. And so I was just wondering if like there is somewhere on a spectrum where like you are approaching this problem from entanglement generation causing
mm-hmm.
like some bottlenecks,
mm-hmm.
you can do error mitigation.
Mm-hmm.
And over there, it was like, how much entanglement can you extract from something noisy that you have?
Mm-hmm.
So I was just wondering if there's like a meeting point somewhere. Yeah, like just
yeah.
to say that I thought that there was an entanglement connection even in error.
Yeah.
So.
This is a, thank you for bringing this up. I didn't know about this paper. Yeah, I'll look into it.
Is
yes.
there any immediate extension to an average case complexity you can get for some family of circuits?
Yes, for some family of circuits, which is, so the reason there is this immediate extension is because the cleave construction doesn't produce just one circuit, it produces an ensemble of circuits. So in the end, what we do is like we have an ensemble of circuits for which like the expectation over this ensemble of this D is very small. And so our result also holds for the ensemble of circuits, but of course it's an ensemble of circuits that requires like all-to-all connectivity.
Mm-hmm.
So the same criticism applies to this ensemble. And also, this ensemble is kind of like, why would anyone care about this ensemble, right? It's not like the kind of circuit that you would use in real life. Yeah.
Okay.
like circuits in real life, though, they often do entangle very quickly. Like, wouldn't there otherwise seem like doing any interesting computation on a
right
quickly?
Right. So I think that some entanglement is necessary to do computation, but like I think the idea is that you shouldn't do too much entanglement. And also, circuits in real life typically don't entangle as quickly as these circuits, because these circuits are, they're specifically chosen such that like their correlation spread very fast, because like that's why you need the all-to-all connectivity.
That's definitely valid. I was thinking about circuits in like algorithms that people have written.
Right. But we care about the regimes where error mitigation is useful, which is not really the regimes where you have like such connectivity.
Yeah.
One final question. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that some QML subroutines no longer have quantum advantage mm-hmm. as a result. Can you comment a bit more on what kind of subroutines?
Yeah, so I think we can show a result that like basically kernels don't have this like quantum, don't really have this like quantum advantage at very high depths.
Any more questions? Good, let's thank you again.
Thank you.